I would like to welcome you guys to the Federal Reserve Perspective panel. Our speakers today will be Kathleen Hayes of Bloomberg Television and Radio, and Neil Kashkari of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. I would like to thank you all for coming, and I hope you enjoy the session. Without further ado.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for being here. Talking about the fact that I think when I was in college, and maybe when Neil was in college, we didn't have events like this. We didn't have student investment forums. And I think it's so exciting to be here with you and to have a top Federal Reserve official joining us. I just want to put a little background on myself. We're going to get a lot of background from Neil, and also so you understand just how lucky we are to be sitting here with the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. I started doing this years ago, and back then, Federal Reserve officials spoke very, very seldom in public, and you had to work and work for months, if not years, to get an interview. Now, this whole trend towards transparency and the Fed wanting the public to know what they're doing and why they're doing it has really made it much more possible for us to know what's on their mind, know how and why they're making policy. At the same time, it is still really a privilege to have someone like Neil Kashkari speaking to us today, especially at a venue like this. You're in a room where you're going to be able to ask questions. You're going to get to hear what's on his mind about policy and the economy, finance. And I'm going to get into a little bit more about Neil himself and how he got to this position and what he is aiming for now. I'll just briefly tell you a few things about Neil. He helped set up the TARP and run the TARP during the financial crisis. He ran for governor of California on the Republican ticket. And he's sitting here with us. We know he didn't win this time. He also started out his career as a tech analyst for Goldman Sachs out in San Francisco. After studying engineering and working as an engineer, went to Wharton for his MBA. So he's somebody with a very diverse and interesting background. So with no further ado, I want to really get to the news of the week, Neil, because the Federal Reserve had a very important meeting. Markets around the world watching, other central bankers as well. And part of it was expected. The Fed raised its key rate by 25 basis points, and it left the door open not just to two more hikes this year, but three. That's a bit controversial. And what surprised people is the Fed speeded up the pace of rate hikes for the next 2 years. Are you on board with this decision?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Kathleen. Thanks to all of you for having me. I supported the decision this time because it represented continuity. You know, we have Janet Yellen was the Federal Reserve Chair. Her term concluded. We have a new chair in Jerome Powell. And I thought the decision this week represented continuity of what the Federal Reserve has been saying we're going to do. So in that sense, I supported the decision, and all of our colleagues are trying to balance our dual mandate of stable prices and maximum employment. Personally, I think we have a ways to go before we have achieved our dual mandate objectives. So one of the things that surprised us throughout the recovery is the unemployment rate has fallen from 10% now to 4.1%. We would have expected a lot of wage growth with that job market getting stronger. And we keep thinking we're coming close to maximum employment, and then all of these Americans come back into the job market, suggesting we were not really at maximum employment. And so for me, the thing that I'm really focused on is looking at wage growth. You know, we're trying to assess supply and demand in the labor market. And if you want to assess supply and demand in a market, start by looking at the price. And wage growth has not really accelerated very much. And so to me, that tells me that there's still some slack in the labor market. I want to see more wage growth. When I see more wage growth, I'll have more confidence that we are approaching our 2% inflation target, and then I'll be more supportive of rate increases.
But you did support.
Well,
this
I was
decision.
Not a voter.
I know, but Jay Powell said at, was it Humphrey Hawkins? He was asked about voters versus non-voters, just to catch you up. Not all of the 12 district bank presidents vote. They rotate that vote unless you're president of the New York Fed. But what he said was, I don't even pay attention to who's a voter. I listen to the influencers. I listen to the arguments. So what did you argue for? Did you support this decision?
I argued that if I had been sitting in the chairman's seat, I would have raised rates because we had told the markets we're going to raise rates. And for continuity's sake, I think it's important. But if I look at our dual mandate objectives and I look at the data, I don't think the data itself supports rate increases at this point. in terms of achieving our dual mandate objectives. I personally would like to see more wage growth and have more confidence that we've actually used up slack in the labor market. Then I'll support more interest rate increases.
Okay, so let's look at dots. And again, summary of economic projections. The FOMC, every 3 months, updates their forecast for GDP growth, unemployment, and inflation. And based on that, they each individually say, I think this is how much we should hike rates this year, cut or not. Okay, and that's where we get this dot plot. The big debate or the big question was, would the Fed had the consensus was going into 2018, 3 rate hikes is what we need. Ah, but might they raise it to 4? We've had tax cuts and a lot of stimulus, right? Did you raise your dot?
I did bring some of my dots forward a little bit in light of the fact that there's a lot more fiscal stimulus now and there's a lot more spending now than we had realized there would be 6 months ago. So I brought some of my path a little bit further forward. The big open question is, what do all of these fiscal packages mean over the long term? And that at this point is totally unclear. Is it actually going to change the growth trajectory of the U.S. economy? Is it actually going to lead to more productive investment and a higher productive capacity? We just don't know. So we can model with some confidence the short-term stimulative effects, but does that lead to a long-term faster growth rate? We don't know.
So that's news, you know, if you move your dots even forward. Do you have more than 2 hikes this year?
Well, I'm not going to get into my specific. the dots are anonymous for a reason, and I want to respect
that. Well, I think one of the things that puzzled people, now, if you believe in the tax cuts, and they're going to boost spending, although maybe more for wealthier people, because as other Fed officials have pointed out, that's where they're heavily weighted, some question about how much the corporate tax cut will stir business spending, because that depends on a lot of things,
including
the cost of capital is just one. Meanwhile, we've got retail sales actually negative for the past 3 months. The Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank has this really cool thing. It's the GDP nowcast. They look at every number that comes in, and they say, okay, what's GDP going to do this quarter? It started up close to 4% for the first quarter. It's down under 2% now. So in what could look like a pause or some loss of momentum in the economy, the Fed is moving ahead toward tighter policy. In fact, some people still want 4 rate hikes. It's a very narrow division between 3 and 4 now.
Well, again, we're always trying to balance. We get so much data. If you turn on Bloomberg TV or other channels, you're going to get so much data every day. And so we have to pay attention, look at this, but not overreact to short-term movements in the data. So the most important things that I focus on are our 12-month inflation measures. Are we actually getting back to our 2% inflation target? Looking at wage growth, looking at inflation expectations. I personally try not to overreact to short-term movements up and down in the data. The data moves around quite a bit. And so I agree. I mean, the data that you articulated for the last few months is what it is. But I think we're looking at the next year, the next 2 years, and then over the longer run.
Do you, Neil Kashkari, in the data, in all the information you get from people across your district, are you see signs that wages are really rising enough to make a big difference in inflation this year?
No. The most common conversation I have with firms, I've said this many times, is I ask them, I say, what's your biggest challenge? And they say, we can't find workers. And I say, okay, are you raising wages? They say no. And then I say, well, then you're just whining, right? You want more of something, but you're not willing to pay for it. That's called whining. And so until I hear businesses actually say, no, we're raising wages to attract workers, then I'm going to know that they're serious. And again, we're seeing, I don't want to, again, overreact to one jobs report, but a 300,000 number comes in the payroll report, the last one. We need about 100 or 120,000 jobs per month to keep up with population growth. So for the economy to create 200,000 jobs or 300,000 jobs, that means we're using up slack that was somewhere in the economy. That's remarkable, and that's happening at a time of modest wage growth. Imagine how workers are going to respond if wage growth picks up. I think we're going to see even more people get drawn into the job market. And so the most important determination we are trying to make, in my opinion, is how much slack is in the labor market. And I think the headline unemployment rate, which right now is 4.1%, that's historically been a pretty good proxy for slack in the labor market. I think that gauge is broken because of the financial crisis. And a lot of people have given up and are only now starting to re-enter the labor market.
I want to ask you about another big piece of news this week.
Sure.
And that was President Trump putting tariffs of up to $60 billion on Chinese exports. The Chinese, of course, are responding in kind. We saw a big sell-off in the U.S. stock market yesterday. We saw an Asian stock market sell-off overnight. Things are steadying today. But up until now, most Fed officials have sort of, I think, downplayed tariffs. If steel, aluminum, no big deal. Smart part of the economy, won't have much impact. This is something, though, that raises a specter, and many people are saying these words now, quite seriously. Trade war? Can the Fed shrug off a trade war? What does it mean for the economic outlook?
No, of course not. I mean, if there was actually a full-fledged trade war between the U.S. and China, it would have a dramatically negative impact on the U.S. economy and on the global economy. And we couldn't shrug it off, and we'd have to look at what do we think it means for the outlook for inflation and the outlook for growth. I think I understand what the administration is trying to do, because I think for 20 years we have been in a conversation with China saying, hey, you should be responsible stakeholders. It's in your interest to be free traders. And I think we've learned that China's going to do whatever China's going to do. I mean, we can talk to them all we want, and they're going to do whatever they want to do. And so I think the administration is saying, we want to show that we actually have some recourse. Now, the danger is it goes down a very bad path, and it leads to two major economies in a trade war. Obviously, we have to try to avoid that. But I also understand the desire to try to have a level playing field in terms of free trade around the world.
What were the effects of an actual trade war discussed at the FOMC meeting this week?
It was discussed in the context of these, and Chairman Powell talked about this in his press conference, in the context of downside. We're always looking at what are the upside scenarios for the U.S. economy that could surprise us, and what are the downside scenarios that could surprise us. 6 months ago, we were not talking about trade as a downside risk to the U.S. economy. Now trade is a downside risk, and you know, I don't think we have a good sense of putting a probability on it, but it's something we have to pay attention to.
Is the biggest risk, inflation, because imports will cost more. Of course, the Fed might like that. Is the biggest risk less growth because it hurts our exports? Is the biggest risk financial instability? And I'm thinking of 2015 going into 2016, the Federal Reserve was thinking it was going to raise rates 3 times that year. First, we had a Chinese stock market sell-off, caused a lot of volatility in the U.S. and around the world, the Brexit vote in the summer. We're not anything like that now, but it seems to me that this is something that could impinge on the expected path. But in terms of where you're looking for something that would change the path, what is it?
Well, all of those things that you said, I think, are reasonable cases, and we'd have to look at it. I can't predict. My best guess is it would just be a shock to confidence. Confidence is actually enormously important to the U.S. economy, not just to the stock market, but to businesses making investment decisions. And if there was a trade war and a major shock to global confidence, then I think that you would see that manifest itself not only in equity prices, but also in bond spreads, et cetera, and the cost of financing for businesses would go up, and that would have an effect on economic growth.
You have already warned, and maybe you've changed your mind about this, but I believe as recently as December, you have said that Fed rate hikes, you were concerned they could actually help tip the economy into recession. So you already see that risk. Now we see this uncertainty and these other risks. Is the risk of recession higher now than it was?
All of our metrics that we look at to try to forecast recession say the risk of a recession in the next year or two is very low. But let me tell you, it's always low until it isn't. So don't take a whole lot of comfort from that. These indicators are not that helpful. I think there are risks. Look, there are risks in the upside and downside. Right? We had a strong wage growth number in January that markets reacted to. If wage growth picks up, that's an upside to the economy. If there are trade imbalances or trade disruptions, that's a downside risk. I think the risks are probably about even right now.
Why does the U.S. dollar keep getting weaker? Now, we have had strength in the last 24 hours on this, you know, risk on, risk off, risk aversion, where you go in with your money, right, yen weakened, and then it popped back. Meanwhile, the trend has been Fed's hiking rates, signaling more rates, and dollar has been weakening. Why? What is the signal to the Fed?
You know, we're not sure. I asked my economists, I've got a great team of economists at the Minneapolis Fed about predicting the dollar, and they say, you know, ask us anything else, but trying to predict where currencies are going is probably the hardest job that they have. It could be moving around for a lot of different reasons. It could be that markets don't believe the rate path forecast that the Fed is putting out there. Right? If you actually look at where Fed funds futures are, they are forecasting a shallower path than what the committee is transmitting in the summary of economic projections. And so, you know, currencies end up moving not just based on what central banks do, but what they do relative to what people think they're going to do and how those expectations change. So trying to unravel that, I think, is quite complicated.
A weaker dollar pushes up oil prices. That helps the Fed reach its 2% inflation target, which they want to reach because they they feel that that will put some juice in the economy, right? Then firms can raise prices. We can get our paychecks a little bigger. At the same time, higher oil prices, higher gasoline prices, heating oil prices, he's from Minneapolis after all, that hits your pocketbook. So how are you viewing that?
Well, we look at, all of these things move around, and we've got very sophisticated economic models where we say, and the board staff in Washington especially runs many different scenarios on, you know, if this happens or that happens, what's the feedback loop to the U.S. economy? If something happens in Europe, we're not setting monetary policy for the benefit of Europe or for the benefit of Asia. We're setting U.S. monetary policy for the benefit of the United States of America and the citizens and Americans that we work for. But we also recognize that when we move monetary policy in the U.S., it'll have effects globally, which can then rebound back to the U.S., and we try to model that loop. And so we look at all of these things and try to just make the best assessment we can, given the fact that the data is imperfect, it often has a lag, and these things often work in conflict with one another.
You know, one of my colleagues pointed out to me, the obvious, but still, you hike the Fed funds rate above the rate of inflation this week, so we now have positive real rates for the first time in a decade. Is monetary policy tight now? Is it too tight? Is it just right?
Well, there's a concept that we focus a lot of our attention on what we call the neutral interest rate, the neutral real interest rate. This is the interest rate that balances savings and investment in the economy. And we can't measure it directly. We can estimate where we think it is right now, and there are a range of estimates. It's probably very close to zero, neutral real interest rate right now. And this is being set for the last 30 years or so, it's been gradually declining. And this is being set by broader macroeconomic forces, such as demographic trends. The fact is, advanced economies are having fewer kids than they had in the past, and their populations are aging. It's being set by productivity and technology development. So we're trying to assess this all the time. My best guess is that monetary policy is probably pretty close to neutral right now, but there are a range of perspectives on this. I think some people would argue we're still somewhat accommodative. I think we're probably pretty close to neutral, and if we keep raising rates, we'll end up providing some tightening to the economy. But again, we don't know for sure, and that's what makes this challenging.
It certainly is. One more thing, I think, and I want to give a shout out to my colleague. Okay, put a name on him, Matt Bosler, who you know very
sure.
Well, one of our bright econ Fed stars at Bloomberg News. In terms of the idea of inflation, Fed's been saying for the longest time transitory factors have been holding it down. The target's 2%. The headline number, 1.7. The core takeout food energy, 1.5. We've only been at or above 2% once in, what, 5 years?
Or longer.
The average of the last 8 years is less than 2%. Fed has not gotten there. So is it transitory, or, and again, as somebody who was a software analyst years ago, I know you've not followed as closely, but still, has the world changed? We've got Amazon, we've got rampant price discovery, wage discovery. Is that what people are thinking? Maybe that's there, but dismissing?
Well, that's one of the theories that that people offer for why inflation has been consistently so low. I'm skeptical of that, because at the same time that inflation has been low, and you have Amazon and et cetera, productivity growth has also been low, not just in the U.S., in Europe, in advanced economies around the world. If the tech sector was doing such transformation of U.S. industry leading to low price growth, I would have expected to simultaneously see high productivity growth, but we're not. And so that makes me skeptical. I think more likely inflation expectations have gotten anchored at somewhat less than our 2% target. And that's very difficult when inflation expectations are anchored a little bit low. It's very hard for a central bank to pop them up just a little bit. And so that's why I think we're seeing it in the U.S., we're seeing it in Europe, we're seeing it in Japan. I mean, Japan has a very low unemployment rate in the twos. They have the same kind of productivity growth that we're seeing here in the U.S. They're not seeing much wage growth, and they're not seeing much inflation. I think that's because Japanese inflation expectations have gotten really anchored near zero.
When you say Japan, you make me think of China. China is, there's so many threads to follow in China right now. New officials, Xi Jinping has risen, elevated himself to more of a Mao supreme leader in China now, right? Yi Gang is the new head of the People's Bank of China, the Federal Reserve equivalent in China. And actually, he came out of the gate saying, we're going to do financial reforms, is what China needs. But when you look at China in this matrix of I'm a Federal Reserve official trying to guide the U.S. economy through all these forces and changes internally and externally. What's important about China to you?
Well, I think stability is important. I think our trade relationship with China is very important to the U.S. economy. We do run scenarios. If China had some type of a financial crisis or some type of an asset crisis, what do we think the reverberation would be back to the U.S. economy? And then what do we think that would mean for monetary policy? So, again, we're running lots of different scenarios. These are very hard to predict. And so we just want to be ready if we start to see signs of one of these scenarios playing out to try to understand what is the consequence for the U.S. economy. Again, I just want to repeat, we work for the American people. Our job is to try to optimize the U.S. economy given the goals that Congress has given us. And so we have to pay attention to the whole world, but we're trying to figure out what that means for the U.S. economy.
You've done a lot of jobs. You're very well educated. I think a lot of people see the rise of China, not necessarily as the U.S. falling lower, but that's going to be the main economic power, political power, even military power. From the U.S. side, do you see that too? What should we be doing if we want to maintain our position in the world?
Our position in the world is all driven by our economy. If you read, I read a lot of American history, countries win because their economies are strong. And so the best thing that we can do is what you're doing here right now, which is educating as many of our young people with the best possible education to innovate and to compete in the global economy. I mean, no country comes remotely close to the U.S. in innovation. I mean, it's number one and then number 10. I mean, the U.S. is the top, you know, 1 through 9. There's no one's even close. We need to keep that edge, and we're going to keep that edge by investing in research, by investing in our young people to pursue great educations, great careers, pursue innovation. That's what's going to keep the U.S. ahead. But by the way, we have competition around the world. I would never trade place with anybody else. So China's rising, but man, I feel very good about where we are.
So I want to broaden out now a bit around the more monetary policy and economy to things that I think are not necessarily something that are in your purview specifically as a Federal Reserve official, but I think are I'm sure things you're watching and are interesting to all of us. And again, harkening on, okay, you graduated engineering, you worked as an engineer, you went to Wharton to get your MBA, then you landed as a software analyst. And this is some years ago, so analyzing the software was somewhat different then, right? And he's only 35.
No, I'm not.
I know. But anyway, Facebook, okay? You and the bank have a Facebook page, right? If you've got to follow him on Twitter, and me too, but he just tweets constantly, very, very active in social media. So now all of a sudden the news, Facebook is in the news in ways they don't want to be. We've got bots potentially controlled by other entities trying to influence our elections and all kinds of things. Then Facebook, we learned that there was some misuse, allegedly, or not so allegedly, of data. So first of all, As a very public official with a Facebook page, does this make you at all nervous?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things about social media, one of its benefits is this anonymity. But you can see now this anonymity leads to abuse. And so I've seen on Twitter, as an example, I've seen people put forth the proposal that everybody on Twitter should be able to verify themselves. And then you or I could say, you know what, I only want to interact with people who have chosen to verify themselves. That's an interesting idea that might actually clean up the abuse, but also some of the vitriol where anonymous people are just attacking with hateful messages and whatnot. So I think there are steps that can be taken and that we should take and that these social media companies should take. And if they don't take it, I would expect political leaders to take it to try to make this environment safer for everybody.
More regulation then?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen over and over again, if industry is unwilling or unable to appropriately put in place the protections that their customers need, then the government will probably step in and do it for them.
Bitcoin, you have weighed in on Bitcoin. I mean, of course, when it was going up to 17,000, 18,000, 19,000, then everybody wanted to know Bitcoin. I get, what is it, seven, below seven now? I said, I guess below 1,000, I might buy it. I don't know if I'll ever get in that market. But I think most people agree it's not really a currency. And if we brought this out to cryptocurrencies, they're not currencies. Now, let Neil give you the reasons they aren't. Not store of value, et cetera. However, I think people are agreeing this has become a financial asset. Okay? So do you think this, as a financial asset, do you think this is going to stand the test of time?
I don't know. I mean, the biggest criticism that I have of virtual currencies is the reason that they're not currencies is because the barrier to entry for a new one is zero. And so there's now 1,500 plus different virtual currencies. There, I saw there's banana coin. Yesterday I saw an article, there's something, a jalapeno coin is now out. So it's become a farce. It's a joke. You can go create your own version tomorrow. And by having all of these clown coins out there, it undermines the whole confidence in the whole set of them. And what makes the U.S. dollar special? U.S. dollar is special because if you go in your basement and you try to print U.S. dollars, you're going to get a knock on your door from the United States Secret Service, and they're going to put you in jail. So the U.S. government has a monopoly on creating this currency, and that monopoly is what gives it ultimately the confidence and its value. And so, you know, who knows, in the next 20 years, is this, are these cryptocurrencies going to find some use? Maybe. Maybe in version 15,000, somebody will come up with a better widget. But the idea that this is going to compete against the dollar or the euro or the yen, it's just not, it's not credible in the near future.
I'm looking here. Jack Dorsey, founder of Twitter and Square, expects Bitcoin to become the world's single currency in about 10 years.
Yeah. let's see these predictions. If he wants to take all of his net worth and invest it in Bitcoin, I'll be impressed.
Does it have any implications for the Fed, though? Quite seriously, Andrew Haldane, chief economist at the Bank of England, has talked about the possibility of issuing, I guess, a pound-type coin. I think there's a lot of interesting work that suggests that central banks actually, what could help if you issued a Fed coin and you want to impose negative interest rates on people, that's what happened. We didn't quite get to negative in the U.S., but they had slightly negative in Japan and Europe. You could do that. I mean, as a Fed policymaker.
I'm not sure what it even means. People talk about the Fed issuing a Fed coin. I don't even know what that means. I mean, so many of your transactions that you and I undertake every day are done electronically, where you're not handling bills. So what's the difference between a Fed coin and a dollar you have in your electronic bank account? It just isn't obvious to me. Unless it just means that every individual has an account at the Fed, and then the Fed could say, okay, well, we're going to charge negative interest rates on your account. So I just think this market and the space is so new, we don't even know what the questions mean, let alone what the answers are.
So we're just going to continue walking through Neil Kashkari's career. So next, there you are, kind of mid-2000s, and Hank Paulson, also Goldman, ends up being Treasury Secretary. You end up being asked to come to Washington and start working in that team. But I really want to focus on around 2007-2008 financial crisis is starting. First, we have Bear Stearns bailed out by the Fed, and then Lehman collapses. And that's when you were really pulled in to the thick of it, running TARP, helping to set TARP up, and helping get us through a very, very difficult time. What is it about that experience that has informed your very serious proposal for a huge increase in bank capital? You and Ron Feldman, the Minneapolis Fed, working on this together. Because a lot of these people say, oh, Neil, forget it. The banks don't need that much capital. It would hurt the industry, hurt the economy. But what I want to start with the TARP part. You went through that. What did you see that you said, no, this is what you must do now?
Well, I saw in the worst of the financial crisis, we had no choice. I was there as an official in the Bush administration. We were a free market administration. We hated the idea of using taxpayer money to support private sector. And yet the entire U.S. economy was on the verge of collapse. Instead of 10% unemployment, we could have been in a Great Depression scenario of 25% unemployment. And at that point, you have no choice. You have to take taxpayer money to stabilize the financial system, not because the banks or the homeowners who maybe bought homes they shouldn't have, not for their sake, but for everybody else's sake, to save the U.S. economy. So it was the right thing to do. But the question is, how do we avoid having to do that again in the future? Right? If you look at history, human history, it's full of financial crises. We keep repeating the same mistakes that prior generations have made before. So I am sure that there's going to be some future crisis that we cannot see on the horizon. And I don't know if it's in 10 years or 50 years, but it will happen again. And the question is, can we have a financial system that is strong enough so when they make big mistakes, they are strong enough to endure those mistakes and you don't have to turn to the taxpayers? And so this is like the analogy I use that the banks hate is it's like a nuclear reactor, right? You all understand if a nuclear reactor melts down it's devastating for society, and we will spend whatever it takes to stabilize that reactor. So we could either ban nuclear power, which we've not done, or we could put a lot of regulations around it to minimize the chance that it melts down in the first place. That's what I'm proposing. Let's put in place, let's make the banks have enough capital so that if they make mistakes, they can withstand those mistakes and they don't risk bringing down the U.S. economy.
Do you have any hope that anybody's going to adopt anything like this anytime soon?
Well, you never know. I mean, right now the winds are clearly blowing against us and there's a deregulation move. But you never know. I mean, there's this provision, it's pretty technical, called bail-in debt, of this debt that they've introduced that's supposed to convert to equity in a crisis to recapitalize the bank. Europe has embraced this full-throated, as have we. In the last year, this debt has been tested 4 times and failed 3 times. So at some point, we're going to wake up and realize that this clever mousetrap that we think is so clever to protect taxpayers is not actually going to work. And maybe then we'll say, you know what? We just need to make sure the banks have enough skin in the game.
Okay, now, Tarr, he's leaving Washington. What am I going to do now? Oh, why not go to work for PIMCO? And I believe you helped develop some more the equity side of the business while you were there. However, it's a big, big bond firm, so I think I can ask you about stocks and or bonds. And I think I really appreciate that working at a financial firm, I think, for a Federal Reserve official is a huge plus, because you really get such a feel for markets. And that as you implement policy, that's a big part of what you have to monitor and think about. You were concerned about the yield curve. You know, a flat yield curve can signal, oh, things are slowing down, if it inverts, wow, that's in the past, that's not always, but often preceded a recession. What is the message from the bond market to you right now?
Well, I am continuing to pay attention to the yield curve. So the yield curve, I don't know where it is this morning, but it had steepened in the first part of this year, and then it started to flatten back out again. And that's just an indicator. When I look at the history that an inverted yield curve often forecasts a recession, as Kathleen said, often but not always, my interpretation from that is, okay, the Fed can create recessions. Right? If we over-tighten monetary policy, maybe intentionally because we want to get inflation down, we have the power to create recessions. And so to me, it is a warning light that we need to pay attention to, that maybe the neutral interest rate is lower than we think it is, and maybe the bond market is telling us that we're starting to tighten too much or we're getting close to neutral. So, and it's complicated because you've got the term premium in the bond market that moves around, and so it's not a perfect, although what you're getting a sense of hopefully is a lot of these indicators are imperfect, and we have to apply some judgment to see what we think they mean. And I think the yield curve is an example of that. So I continue to pay attention to the yield curve. The fact is, even with all this treasury issuance, the 10-year has not taken off, you know, considerably, hasn't broken up through 3. That tells me that the bond market is saying we're probably not in for a rapid growth environment. We're probably in for more of a moderate growth environment.
Just a quick question, Gracie. What is your growth forecast for the first quarter?
I would need to go back and look.
That's okay. How about for the year?
For the year, it's, you know, mid to high 2s.
Okay, yeah. So you also see the impact of the tax cuts.
We do. I mean, if the Congress cuts taxes, it's going to put more money in the pockets of individuals and businesses, and they're going to spend some of that, and that's going to lead to more economic growth in the short term. I think that's easy to understand. The harder part to understand is, what does it mean for the long-term trajectory? Does it actually boost the growth potential of the U.S. economy? At this point, that's totally unclear.
Okay, so he's Congress. Governor, you ran for governor of the state of California. Congratulations. That's got to be a very exciting and very difficult undertaking. And I think it shows another part of you. I don't think there's too many elected officials, people who've been elected to office or even run. I know Richard Fisher ran for Congress back in the day when he was before President Dalstead. But you also have not shied away from issues that some people would say are really outside the purview of monetary policy, which is great, no problem. But or I just want to ask you about immigration in this sense of policy more broadly, and what you think is important in the world, immigration. You wrote a piece recently. Immigration is a slam dunk. You said it's a. I guess it's the basketball's on my head.
Yeah, I don't remember what the headline was.
But
we don't get to write the headlines for op-eds,
okay,
so I don't
remember.
Anyway,
but Neil's parents immigrated from India. Your wife, who I used to work with, immigrated from the Philippines, and so you have that in your history, in your family, right? Immigration. you are pushing for much more open immigration. So I want you to share why.
Yeah.
And also, I think it's interesting to me, you're a Republican. That doesn't really seem in keeping with where the Republican Party is now.
Well, the argument that I'm making is not a moral one. It's an economic one, which is I'm in favor of more economic growth. And economic growth comes from two sources. It comes from productivity growth, which is R&D and education, but it's very hard to move the needle in the short term. And it comes from population growth. More workers, more consumers, a larger economy. Well, the fact of the matter is our population is growing a lot more slowly than it did in prior decades, simply because our fertility is going down. And so I say to audiences all the time, you have three choices. You can either, number one, accept slower growth. Number two, you can do what Japan is trying to do, and that's subsidize fertility. Tax credits and free child care, it's very expensive, and it doesn't move the needle quickly. Or number three, we can embrace immigration. And that's math. So one time I had somebody in an audience say, you know what, slow growth sounds pretty good. Most people, when they hear that, say, well, gee, I want faster growth, and if my choices are spending a lot of money to subsidize fertility or embracing immigration, and by the way, I'm not saying open borders. I'm saying design the immigration system to feed the needs of the economy. I'm in favor of a skills-based immigration system. I think we as a country would be crazy not to do that because most countries don't have that option. Right? Why is Japan going to subsidize infertility? Because culturally, they do not embrace immigration. It's really countercultural for them, so they have no choice. Immigration, free lunch is what was in that in the op-ed. Immigration is as close to a free lunch for U.S. economic growth as there is. And so I say to my friends across the aisle, I'm in favor of more economic growth. How about you?
Harkening again to public policy more broadly, something else that has become much more of the Federal Reserve debate or thinking, gee, what's going on here, is income inequality. And it really, in a lot of ways, first popped up at Jackson Hole. That's the big Fed conference every year out in Jackson, Wyoming, and it's been going on for about 30 years, and top Fed officials and people from around the world, and it's very, oh God, what do I say, it's like very exclusive to get invited to go there. Of course, automatically you get to go if you're at the FOMC. But when FedUp started showing up, this group, like, how come you're not thinking about workers? And your first reaction is, oh, come on, you guys. The Fed can't boost your wages. The Fed can set inflation or try to keep it under control, and it can help boost growth with interest rates. But over the years, this debate has, I think, become much more the Fed spotlight, to the degree that you, when you became president of Minneapolis Fed, you opened the Center for Income Inequality. What is your research showing, and how, because I still feel kind of, okay, that's great, but what can the Federal Reserve do about income inequality?
Well, we think it's an enormously important economic policy issue, and while you're right, monetary policy may not be able to close gaps between different groups. If we have more PhD economists than anybody in the world across the Federal Reserve System.
Wow.
So if we can train some of our research power to understanding what are some of the structural factors. I'll give you an example. In America, African-American unemployment is always twice white unemployment. If it's a booming economy and white unemployment is 4, African-American unemployment will be 8. If it's a recession and white unemployment is 6, African-American unemployment will be 12. And even if you go college graduate against college graduate or high school dropout against high school dropout, it's the same ratio. I mean, it's perplexing how it could be that consistent. And so I started asking questions of our researchers at the Fed. Why is that? Why is that gap, that 2-to-1 gap, always there? And we couldn't answer it. And I said, well, you know, if we can't even answer the most basic question of why these gaps exist, we can't hope to design policy solutions. So we at the Minneapolis Fed, with the support of the system, have this research center, the Opportunity and Inclusive Growth Institute, trying to understand, unravel these issues. And if there are things monetary policy can do, great. But if all we're doing is arming other policymakers with the data and research that they need to make informed policy decisions, then we think that's an important role for us to play.
If you have questions, start lining up, because I want to get you guys involved right away. But I guess one more question I have is policy rethink at the Fed, new Fed chair, is inflation targeting really working? You seem to be saying, well, we could maybe undershoot, overshoot. So two questions, I guess. One, where are you coming down more on the price level targeting? And are you heartened, because you've been just concerned about Fed signaling rate hikes dampening inflation expectations because it makes people think, oh, they don't want to go above 2%. Jay Powell has said at least once, maybe twice already, the new Fed chair, well, sure, inflation can go above 2% sometime and be below 2%. Do you think that's moving the dial in the right direction?
I do. I think Chairman Powell was right to say that. And I think Chair Yellen also said that before. And so I think the money, we have to put our money where our mouth is, right? We keep saying that 2% is a symmetric target. That means over time it can be above, it can be a little bit below. And yet I think our actions suggest it's more of a ceiling. We don't want inflation to cross 2%. So we need to follow our words with action and actually allow the inflation to build. Ultimately, that's what I think we need to do.
Okay, so then don't be shy. I think Neil will answer just about any kind of question you've got. And what I've learned over the years, sometimes you think you have a question that's so obvious and so easy, and you know what? Those are the kind of questions that often get the best answers of the day. So don't hold back. So step up and introduce yourself, and what's your question?
It's on now.
Okay. Hi, I'm Brandon Rush from the University of Arkansas. Thank you for being so accessible. I just wanted to ask, what about the public service? Why is it so important to you, and how has it benefited your career?
Well, I found great personal satisfaction in being involved in public service and working with other people who share in the public mission that we all have. I found that at Treasury. I certainly find that at the Federal Reserve. And it's really fun to work with people like that who have the sense that we have this greater goal that we're trying to achieve. And so I just get a lot of personal fulfillment out of that. And it also gives me the sense that we're working on issues that are important to the country and to the public that we're charged to serve. You know, each of us is different. Each of us is wired differently. This is something that really resonates with me, and I found really resonates with my colleagues. And I think that's how we get compensated, frankly, right? You could have a more lucrative career in the private sector, but compensation comes in different forms.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Logan Chinkin. I'm from Sonoma State University.
Hello.
And I was wondering, what's your opinion about the tax cuts? There's been some worry about inflation rates. I know the CEO of Goldman Sachs last month said he's maybe worried about the economy becoming overheated. And I was wondering what your opinion was on that.
I don't see any evidence that the economy is overheating. I mean, for me, the signals that the economy is overheating is if we're seeing very tight labor markets leading to high wage growth, leading to firms having to raise prices because they have to pay their workers more. That's the traditional way that we think about an overheating economy. So far, that isn't happening yet, and wage growth has been quite modest. So I don't see signs that the economy is overheating. I don't think the economy right now is running, quote, above potential. There's a notion that if the labor market gets so tight, for a time the economy can run above potential, and that leads to overheating. I'm not seeing evidence of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for being here today. My name is Hannah Peterson, and I'm from St. Mary's University in San Antonio, Texas. My question for you today is, you briefly touched on the case with China, specifically within the 24 hours, and said that the Fed and you have been running some potential scenarios on what the future between the U.S. and China may look like. I was curious if you'd be able to delve a little deeper into that regarding what are the potential scenarios, first of all, and what is the most likely and or the most severe out of those scenarios?
Well, I don't know the most likely. And, you know, it seems like the news is changing every day in terms of what the trade relationship is with China. The worst case scenario is, in my view, is a trade war that really triggers a crisis of confidence in the global economy, where you have the two largest economies basically at loggerheads saying we're not going to do business with each other, and yet we absolutely need each other. I mean, so many American products that we use every day come through China, if not manufactured in China, come through China, and the U.S. economy is enormously important to China as well. And so it's kind of like a game of chicken, and if the two cars run into each other, it's a very bad outcome for everybody. And so I unfortunately don't have more details than that, but I think the mechanism is a crisis of confidence, which then you'd see not just the stock market react, but you'd see bond spreads for corporate America probably grow dramatically relative to treasuries, which would then make it harder for businesses to finance their own investment, which will lead to less investment, and then it could cascade on itself.
Thank you.
Hi there, I'm Emily. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
I was just wondering if you thought there was a correlation between low wage growth and low productivity growth that we're seeing, and if firms are not offering higher wages because of that.
No, there's definitely a good question. There's definitely a relationship between productivity and wage growth. You would think that they would be related over time. So some people say that wage growth right now is kind of appropriate, given that we're in a low productivity environment,
right,
which I think makes sense. But if we're looking at wages as a signal that the U.S. economy is tightening, then you would expect to see wage growth grow beyond the wages that that productivity would imply. And we're not seeing that yet. And that's why I don't see evidence that the U.S. economy is overheating yet. But you're right, wage growth at the end of the day is very much related to productivity growth. And that's another reason why we want to get productivity growth higher.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jake Blood. I'm from the University of Dayton, Dayton, Ohio. I just wanted to ask you, do you guys see rate hikes in a very low inflation, like low overheating environment, as at least partially a tool for the Fed to use in the next recession, or are there other reasons? Thanks.
Well, you mean in terms of getting the interest rate higher so that you can cut it? So some people say that we should raise rates so that we have room to cut if a recession were to come. I don't think that argument makes sense to me, and I'll tell you why. Imagine that you're driving down the highway, and you think, well, there might be a hill somewhere down the road. So I'm gonna let off the gas now so that I can floor it if the hill comes. That doesn't make any sense. You'd be much better off just maintaining your speed and then giving whatever gas you have when the hill actually comes. So I don't think that argument holds water. I think my colleagues and I are trying to balance our dual mandate goals to the best of our ability, recognizing that the future is uncertain.
But the normalization, that's what a lot of people say. This is not tightening. We're just normalizing policy. We're just removing accommodation. But if the natural rate of unemployment is much lower than is much lower than we think, then this is already much tighter policy.
Correct. So that's right. So are we normalizing back to something that we're used to, or are we actually tightening? Where the neutral rate of interest is actually enormously important. I think we're probably about even right now with where the neutral rate of interest is. Some people would argue the neutral rate of interest, real interest rate, is positive, and so we might have some room to go. But that's why this is an inexact, this is an art, not a perfect science.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Good question.
My name is Danny Denaghi. I'm with Truman State University in Kirksville, Missouri. I was wondering why you highlighted the 2% inflation rate as the ideal inflation rate. I know it might be caused by wage increases, and it may be an incentive to spend your money in the economy, but there's also several costs associated with inflation. Why is it not zero or lower?
Well, I get this question a lot. Why not zero? And I'll give you my answer. And most advanced economies have agreed that 2% is about right. It's not, you could argue it should be 2.5, or some people say 3, some people say 1.5. But most advanced economies, central banks have settled on 2%. The reason it's not zero, in my opinion, is because deflation is really bad. So if we have falling prices and you have student loans, and the economy, prices in the economy are falling, your student loans are getting bigger and bigger and bigger as a share of the economy, harder and harder for you to pay off. So we all agree we want to avoid deflation. And to me, we need some room for error. So we've been coming up short on our inflation target for the last 5 or 10 years, call it ballpark 1.5% inflation instead of 2. Well, if we had a 0% inflation target and we were missing on the downside by 0.5, you'd be in deflation right now. And your student loans would be getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So that 2% inflation target gives us a little bit of operating room. It's not a high inflation rate. We want to keep inflation low, but we want it a little bit above zero, and that's where 2% comes from.
Is it really that important? I mean, I guess another question would be, do we need to get to 2% inflation? And I think it asks the same thing about Japan. 2% inflation has become the what everyone around, all the big central banks have adopted. Japan, of course, a couple years ago, they were in deflation. They're back up to about 1%. We're stuck between 1.5 and 2. If the economy's growing, if jobs are growing, and if unemployment is falling, why worry about whether or not we're at 2% inflation?
Well, this is where, when people talk about what about the next recession, it actually does matter. If inflation expectations were to get anchored at 1% rather than at 2%, that then does limit the Fed's ability to react in a future recession, because it's real interest rates that matter. And so that will limit our ability. We'll hit the zero lower bound and have less dry powder, so to speak. And so it is important that we hit our 2% inflation target.
So the Fed is currently unwinding the balance sheet, and I believe the current timeline for having it completely unwound is by 2021, correct me if I'm wrong. What sort of impact do you see if the economy were to turn down before then, let's say 2019, 2020, you know, before it's completely unwound? What sort of impact do you see that having, both in the Fed's ability to, you know, do something similar to TARP or in general?
Well, Chairman Powell talked about this in his press conference a couple of days ago, where he said, and Chair Yellen before him said, that our primary monetary policy tool is adjusting the federal funds rate, the overnight interest rate that we moved up on Wednesday. So that would be, if there was a downturn, our first move would be probably not to further hike rates and maybe to cut those rates. But if we needed to, if the downturn was severe enough, we could always press pause on the roll-off of our balance sheet, or if necessary, if it was extreme enough, even consider expanding our balance sheet yet again as a way to try to drive down long-term interest rates. So those tools are available to us. We're hoping we're not going to need to use them, and our first priority is going to be using the interest rate to adjust the stance of monetary policy.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Ryan Underwood, and I'm representing the University of Minnesota Duluth.
Nice.
And my question is, when you're looking at demographics, specifically baby boomers, how are you factoring that into in their retirement? How are you factoring that into your job outlook?
But it's a very important part of our analysis. So we look at, there's a term called labor force participation that we pay a lot of attention to. That's what's the percentage of adults that are in the job market. They either have a job or they are looking for a job. We know that that is trending down, or we believe it is, just because our society is aging. As more people retire, you're going to just see a smaller percentage of Americans in the job market. That has now flattened out over the past few years, much to our surprise. So us trying to assess, are workers retiring? Are they working longer? That's actually very important in our assessment of, is there still slack in the labor market or not? So we've been surprised that people are, in some cases, working longer. We would have expected them to retire, but they're choosing to work longer. Or people were in retirement, and now they're coming back into the job market. It's a very important factor. But again, we can model it, but then we have to pay attention to what people actually choose to do. And a lot more people are choosing to work, and I think that's a great thing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chuck Jones from Sonoma State University.
Hi there.
And earlier you mentioned that we have a habit of repeating mistakes with the economy, in particular things that cause crises. How strongly do you feel that our habit of removing the protections that we put in place after these crises, like how strongly do you feel that that impacts the next one?
It absolutely does. And the thing is, we all have fairly short memories. I mean, I'm talking to all of you about the financial crisis, which is now 10 years ago, which is probably just a vague recollection for most of you, I'm guessing, right? I mean, if you were 21 and you were 11 years old at the time of the financial crisis, you probably was not front and center of what you were doing when you were 11 years old. And by the way, 10 years from now, it's going to be a further shadow in our memories. And so that's the danger for all of us. And we can never prevent all future crises. You know, societies are prone to making these, I call them mass delusion events or mass stupidity events. We do things, we think they make sense, we're all doing it, then it's revealed that it was really dumb. It's probably going to happen again. And so we have to try our best to pass these lessons on and then put in place the appropriate regulations, but it's not going to be perfect.
But it is a hard sell, isn't it? Because you inherited a mantle, I don't know if everybody realized at the time, even people who followed the Fed very closely, that Gary Stern, who was your predecessor's predecessor at the Minneapolis Fed, he and Ron Feldman wrote a book in 2004 called Too Big to Fail. And it was all this research and arguments about how too big to fail was a big problem in this country and economy, and something had to be done. So it hasn't been like nobody knows, but I
Correct.
Think when things are good, nobody wants to look. Wall Street doesn't want to look. They just want to, hey, if Citibank is rising, great, I'll invest and make money.
When I first went to Treasury in 2006, all the rage in economic policy circles was capital markets competitiveness. At the time, everyone thought the U.S. capital markets were overregulated and we were losing out to Asia and to Europe and we're losing our competitive edge. No one had a clue that a year later would be sparking a major financial crisis. And so we do, you know, to your question, we do have a history of forgetting.
My name is Benjamin Barad from the University of Richmond. I'm just wondering, you argued for more wage growth. Do you think that that could lead in the long term to companies moving to automation in order to reduce their labor costs?
I think that's absolutely true. I think that as wages go up, you're going to see businesses making decisions about automation. But that's always been true. Right? That's been true in the history of our economy. And that's part of where productivity growth comes from. And so I'm not one to buy, you know, some people are predicting doom and gloom, the end of labor, you know, robots are going to take over. You know, this is before your time, but if you go back and watch the original Terminator movie, which came out in 1983 or 1984, they predicted Skynet would become self-aware in 1997. All right? It's now 2018, and we're nowhere closer to Skynet. So, and when I was in engineering school, by the way, when I was in grad school, artificial intelligence was also right around the corner. All right, it's in a horse race with cold fusion. Right? They're both 20 years away for the past 50 years. So I think that there are going to be plenty of jobs around. The nature of work is going to change. The nature of these jobs is going to change. People are going to have to adjust. The adjustment's not always going to be easy. But I do think that automation is a good thing. But we also have to keep up with skills development so that people can have jobs that they can contribute.
Tyler Feiken, I'm wondering, in your decision-making process, what weight do you give to quantitative forecasting?
Well, we look at a lot of different forecasts. We look at forecasts from within the Fed. We also look at blue-chip indicators of people in the markets. We look at survey of professional forecasters who are also, and I don't know which of those are using quantitative forecasting or not. We try to look at as wide a range of forecasts as we can, and then reconcile that with what are we hearing from our own business contacts as we travel around the country and around our districts, and then our own judgment based on how the economy is performing. So I don't have a specific quantitative model that I can point to and say that's what I count on. I think it's one of many, many different models that we look at to try to get an assessment. And then we try to stress test these models to say, all right, if we're wrong in this way or wrong on this assumption, what does it mean for the U.S. economy and for inflation?
Hello, my name is Mandarin, and thank you for being here today. I stand for California State University of Fullerton. My question is about the regulation on financial sector. So one of the problems that, one of the reasons that caused the financial crisis in 2008 is that the role between commercial banking and investment banking is mixed together, and it's called problem. That's why we have FRANDA regulation. And now that I see the trend that we tend to ease or losing the regulation that we have on the car sector. So what is your view on this? And will it, you know, it's eventually gonna cause another financial crisis like what we have in 2008.
So Congress right now is considering legislation to roll back some regulations on small, mid-size, and large regional banks, but not yet touching the biggest banks. When I meet with members of the House and Senate, Republican and Democrat, almost everyone agrees that we should relax regulations on community banks because they're not systemically risky for the economy, but also be tougher on the big banks, the biggest banks. And so the legislation that's pending does the former, but it still doesn't address the latter. So what I think we ought to do is relax regulations on community banks, but really make sure the biggest, the giant banks in America have enough capital so that they are safe. And so that's what I'm advocating for. Whether we do it, you know, we'll see.
All right. Thank you.
I think this will be our last question.
Hi, my name is Will Hayes. I'm from the University of Arkansas. My question is concerning productivity growth. I think an easy answer to that is where more people are becoming educated, but I think there's also an argument that there is degree dilution in our country right now. Where do you think there are some other potential and promising sources of productivity growth are? And do you think there's a better way to approach education incentives?
Well, I think on the education front, the returns to higher education just keep going up. And so I guess I don't agree with you that there's an oversupply of educated people in America. I think increasingly so, this is gonna be important for more and more Americans to get higher education. And then, so we know education is part of it. And the other source of productivity growth is research. I think there is a role for taxpayer money to fund basic research, not commercialization, not picking winners and losers, but funding basic science research that industry can then take on and run with and compete and make products. And so I think that that's pretty well understood that through education and investment in research, that's where we can come up with great new technologies. You know, something that's promising on the horizon, though it's not perfect, is self-driving cars and trucks. I mean, when that technology comes, it will free up a lot of time and I don't think that's going to put all truck drivers out of work. Maybe they're driving the last mile. Maybe they're there, you know, at the loading docks, et cetera. It'll be disruptive, but it also could be transformative for the U.S. economy. So things like that are being driven by the private sector. But I do think fundamental research plays an enormously important role.
And my final question to you, since you've got this room full of students who are interested in economics and finance and things, if somebody was thinking about a career at the Federal Reserve, as you mentioned, more PhD economists across the Federal Reserve system than any other place in the world, what would you advise them, or what kind of career opportunities would you say exist?
Well, there are lots of careers. So in the Federal Reserve, we have bank examiners that go examine everything from community banks to large banks. We have large IT departments running payment systems for the U.S. economy and all of the Federal Reserve's networks. So there are a lot of IT jobs at the Federal Reserve. There are also policy jobs, economist jobs, et cetera. We've got law enforcement jobs. So there are a lot of, the Fed is a great place to work, really good, very high quality people committed to public service. So, I mean, I would go to our websites, and there's 12 Federal Reserve banks, and there's the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C. Go to the career websites. Take a look, see what's there. I think we'd like to bring in people out of college, you know, give them a chance, get them some exposure, and see if it ends up being a good fit. And you don't have to, you know, I joined the Fed when I was 43, so you don't have to join the Fed right out of college. You can join the Fed later if that's ultimately what you want to do. My only advice to you is your life is long, your career can be long. You can try different things. I've tried a bunch of different things, and your first job is probably looks like it's very, very important. It's not as important as you think it is. And you'll probably have multiple jobs over the course of your career. So try something, give it a shot. If you like something else, go do it.
And one thing leads to another. But now he reasons that he leaves the door open. So what's your next job going to be, Mr. Kashkari?
I'm very happy at the Minneapolis Fed. I've been here a little over 2 years, and I'm not planning on going anywhere.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen.